Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are leading you through the weekend edition. I also want to refocus everybody back on our website to all the daily editorials we did this week. It was a busy week and rightfully so. There was a lot of news to talk about. Plus, there's still a lot of news coming out of companies that we follow closely on the site. So please have a listen to those company interviews and please get in touch with us. Let us know your thoughts on the companies we're having on, the guests we're having on, and if there are any other topics you really want us to dive into. On this weekend show, we're going to focus a lot on the broad equity markets and also dabble a little bit in the metals. And we have to touch on the interest rate environment here where bonds continue to sell off, yields are rising. Shad and I are kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail side, he writes in The No Trader and a piece called 7-Eleven, where Rick picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs, all with the goal to beat the S&P. Rick, let's start with the S&P because it was 2 weeks ago that you came out to your subscribers saying that you were putting on some tactical shorts. And this last week, you outlined the scenario here where you think the S&P at best goes sideways for the remainder of the year. Summarize these kind of big picture thoughts for the S&P, please, Rick.
Thanks, Corey. Well, we did put on a tactical short, and obviously that provided some benefit for those who did put it on where we had suggested. But let's talk about the bigger picture here, which is whether or not the S&P, which has a high near, rough, I think it's about 45, 46, something like that, is the high. If with the rebound that we saw after Monday sell-off, you know, is not on the downside and then just turns around and goes and starts making new highs again, which several people on the street are looking for. I don't think so. And even if we did make new highs, I don't think it's a melt up. I think it would be a very minimal incremental new high that would come back off. What I'm actually thinking, and this has been a change in thought over, you know, let's say from where I was a month ago, is that between now and year's end, we mostly go sideways. And again, a minor new high doesn't really do anything to change that idea. I don't think that we crush it. I'm in total disagreement for those companies on the street that think we're going 15 and 20% lower. I don't think that's likely. Do I see a 5 to maybe 10%? I think that's possible. And I don't think we go more than a few percent higher from here either. One of the biggest reasons I think that actually comes off of the charts, and I almost wish there was a way that we could put this out for you know, radio listeners, but I'll walk you through this so that you kind of understand what makes me think that we've hit a fairly important inflection point. If you look at where the S&P was back in 2007, in October 2007, we made all-time highs, and that was the high going into the great financial crisis that bottomed in March of 2009. A point loss on that decline in pure point terms, not percentage, but in pure point terms in the S&P was, I think, was just over 910 points, something like that. And if you take the 910 points and think of this, if you were looking at a chart and saw the all-time high in 07 down to the low in 09, a 100% retracement would bring you back to the 07 high, right? It, you know, sold off and then it recouped the entire sell-off. If recouping that sell-off was 100% of what the decline was, then when we went to 1.618 times what that sell-off was, we paused for 8 months in 2015. We literally hit that level, paused for 8 months, before eventually breaking out in the first half of 2016. And then we zipped up, and in late 2019, we hit the next level, which would have been 2.618 times. Why is that? Well, these are Fibonacci numbers, and these are naturally occurring phenomena that exist in nature, and they have been brought to the market years and years ago as being ways of also interpreting the ebbs and flows of the marketplace. And we scooted, we eventually went through that level into the early 2020 high, then we sold off into the March 2020 bottom, which almost sold off back to that 1.618 level, and then, you know, we turned around and shot higher. Well, if you take 2.618 and multiply that times 1.618, you come up with 4.24. And that measurement off of the 2009 low, meaning 4.24 times the decline in points from the 07-09 low added to the 09 low, in other words, 4.29 times that decline, gets you to S&P 4,522. That's roughly 20 S&P points off what is now the all-time high. So that was the high last month. That's the high this month. I would think that it's going to stay the high for the next several months with the chance of a pullback along the way, that if it happened this month and if we took out Monday's low, we could get all the way down to, I'd say, you know, 4,100 or something like that. If it happens next month, it's probably somewhere north of 4,100, but less than 4,200. And that's what I'm thinking, is that we are at a very natural place for the market to pause. The five equity strategists at tier one firms that in the last 2 weeks put out sell signals, I can virtually guarantee we're not looking at that to come up with it. They're fundamental analysts who look at the big picture and say the S&P is overpriced, yada, yada, yada. We're due for a significant decline. So I'm not in that significant decline camp, but I do think we're in a place that we could easily see the market pause for months, which is why I shifted into a probably sideways type mode into year's end, where we don't make any material gain or material loss, but there's still the chance for some pullback. But I really disagree with those who are looking for a major market decline. I don't think it's coming. I think there's too many positive things about the economy that would not have that occur. And you can virtually find plenty of strategists on the street who'll tell you that stocks are cheap versus those who'll tell you stocks are expensive. And which is why I personally only give virtually no credence to the strategists on the street, except I like to collectively look at what they're thinking. And I wrote in that very same report to clients that it is highly unlikely we sell off 15 to 20% from the highs, mostly because five tier one strategists think we would, and they made that call within 1% of what was currently the all-time high. In my 40 years on Wall Street, I have never seen five Wall Street strategists from big firms or small firms, doesn't matter, collectively come out within days of each other that the market was going to take a significant dive when we were within 1% of all-time highs. If anything, you see them typically saying we're going much higher. For them to say we're going much lower makes me really reduce the likelihood in my head that that is going to happen. So that's kind of what I see, guys.
That's an interesting take on it, Rick. And it's uncanny how those Fibonacci numbers often will trump some of the fundamental points of view that some of these analysts have. And yeah, when you have a consensus of everybody thinking it's going lower and they're all on one side of the boat, that is a caution alarm sometimes to think maybe it's a contrarian bet to look at the other side of things and maybe it won't be as severe as they're thinking. But I know that when you track the 7-Eleven report, you're looking at the 11 spider ETFs and looking for the seven that you think will outperform. Even in a sideways market, surely there is a few sectors you have your eyes on that you think may be a little more bullish than the others. Which ones have your eye and which ones do you think may outperform the other sectors, Rick?
So just about a month ago, I upgraded energy in that report and to clients who are, you know, institutional clients, suggesting that that would be a very good time to come back in and overweight energy. And we essentially caught the low of the underperformance that energy had had for several months. So it has outperformed nicely in the past 4 weeks. So that is the sector that I think will do well. And look, oil's pushing virtually near its highs. It's not quite there, but we're not so far away. So you still have oil in the 70s, and that's going to help the energy space. And then certainly I like financials. I upgraded those, I think it was in July, almost a month earlier than I, or maybe even June, upgraded energy. And we did so when rates had fallen down to 1.15%. So we virtually caught the low in that decline. Now, of course, today rates are near 1.45%, and they've had a significant move even in the last couple of days, finally breaking above resistance at between 1.4 and 1.42. So financials should outperform. One of the ones I'm concerned about is if rates continue higher here, which in general I think they will, I think technology, especially big cap tech, is going to have trouble materially outperforming. And therefore, I'm likely in the upcoming October 1st report to lower exposure to the tech sector, simply because growth names, especially growth tech names, have trouble when interest rates go up. The cost of funding is higher, and it's generally not a great environment for them. So we certainly can see financials be better leaders than they've been through, you know, over the last several years. And you know, they've recouped a fair amount of what they've pulled back from the highs this year. So I kind of, just off the bat, I think I favor energy and financials and will lower some exposure into tech. Take that away from being an overweight.
So Rick, is big picture here, one of the most important markets or sectors to watch the bond market, because yields have started to break out again. And it seems like with central bank policies really around the world leaning towards some form of tightening, that the path of least resistance is higher for rates, and that has repercussions for really every market?
Yeah, I think in general, the answer to that is yes. And you, an equity investor always has to look at the bond market. It's historically known as the smarter money. In other words, the bond market figures out what's going to happen often before the equity market does. And if this move in yields is real, and you know, right now the TNX is trading as we record this late Friday afternoon at 1.46%, this is the best level we've been on in a couple months since we broke down. And you've got to kind of pay attention to what bond yields are saying, because they do affect virtually every other market. You know, it affects the gold market. Most people wouldn't put those two together, but higher interest rates become a competitive market for something like gold, which has no dividend, right? You make money in gold simply if the price of gold is higher than where you bought it at, and you lose money if it goes down. There's no advantage to long-term holding the way a utility stock may pay you 4% in a dividend. This pays you nothing. So higher interest rates often compete against gold, because people say, hey, if I can get, you know, a guaranteed money versus getting no money holding gold, unless I speculate correctly and it moves higher, I rather, you know, move. And so those interest rates often depress gold. And gold's only down a couple bucks today. But if you look at, you know, the price of gold at 1750-ish versus what the all-time high was from last August, it's, you know, it's a few hundred dollars different. And gold has underperformed virtually every major asset class this year.
Yeah, Rick, well, let's dive into that for just one second further, because obviously there's the narrative that the interest rates would hurt gold, that, you know, gold's not paying a yield, but there's also the higher uptick in inflation. And so when you look at the uptick in inflation, and I'm not talking so much the tips yield, which are kind of Fed has their fat finger on that. I'm looking more at the CPI inflation, those government metrics that come in. We're still in a negative real rate environment. And so people that are holding dollars, a lot of times when we look at dollars, it's measured against the dollar index of other currencies, but they're not really looking at their purchasing power. Their purchasing power is eroding over time because of inflation. So the argument for gold is, hey, at least this is going to hedge some of that with the inflation, because even if you're making 1 or 2%, you're still losing 2 or 3% to inflation. So what do you think of that counter argument about the rising rates being counterbalanced by inflation?
Well, look, you have gold is the type investment that is used and has historically been used as a hedge against inflation, against disaster, against the currency imploding. I think the cryptos have definitely taken money away from those who might have put it into gold. And certainly, if you look at what the return on, you know, let's say, Bitcoin has been in the last 12 months versus gold, you'd be doing a heck of a lot better, despite the fact that Bitcoin is well off its highs. Gold has lost some of that luster. It doesn't particularly hedge against inflation super well. Inflation is creeping higher, but gold is not. So that's not helping. And bond yields moving up doesn't necessarily mean the short end will move up, but because the Fed has also told us, and now we even see how Fed fund futures are trading, and the fact that you've got more Fed governors looking to raise rates in 2022, whereas months ago, Powell was saying it definitely won't happen until 2023. The interest rate environment is something that needs to be, you know, to go back to your original question, you have to look at the interest rate market when you're trading stocks, commodities, currencies. It is often the foundation behind why a lot of movement takes place in these markets. Not certainly not all, but you're not going to see typically, you know, gold trading at the same price if yields are at 1.6 than if yields are at 1%. And if yields go higher, it's going to be more competition for gold. And gold, look at gold stocks. You know, the GDX is now sub $30. That is a really kind of, you know, this thing is on the precipice of falling again. And this right around $30 to, I think, 32-ish was where the seven-year breakout took place last year. So we shouldn't really, if gold stocks are good to own, we really shouldn't be down here. And if we are down here, we shouldn't stay here down. We shouldn't stay here long. This should be a very quick mispricing. Gold stocks should go up. And if they don't, that's a real signal, too, that people are losing their interest in what the value of gold is supposed to mean from a historical basis.
Rick, what do you take away from the stock moves? Because those are the keys that caught my eye. GDX below 30, close of the week below 30. GDXJ at 39. This is also the lowest weekly close in over a year. People say stocks lead the metal, but either way, the stocks have been getting sold off. They are unloved right now, and the close this week is opening up a lot of downside risk. So are you throwing in the towel on gold stocks yet?
I'm not throwing the towel here, and I own some GDX myself, and I have for years. And, you know, it's very easy to kick myself in the rear end now saying how come I didn't sell at 45, and now it's trading at 30. But if you, and this is something your, you know, listeners can do, pull up a GDX monthly chart, go back 10 years, and you'll see that multiple highs took place around 30 to 31-ish, maybe 32-ish, I'm not even, no, probably between 30 and 31. So the fact that we're 29 and high change doesn't spook me. This is the pullback, but this pullback really kind of has to hold. So I'm not throwing in the towel yet, but I can tell you I'm not a happy camper seeing what gold's doing. And it really, if it's going to hold, it should hold somewhere right around here.
All right, so some pretty defined levels there for GDX and GDXJ. Rick, what about cryptos? Because, look, cryptos are in favor for, I think, a lot of the younger investors. But at the tail end of this week, we did get the news out of China that China is declaring transactions in cryptocurrencies illegal. We're seeing weakness at the tail end of the week, but not a complete washout. I think Bitcoin's down about 5, 6%. Ethereum, some of the smaller coins, those are down 10%. So not a total washout, but that whole regulation argument for the bears, well, China's testing that out right now. What's your takeaway?
So if you let's start off with Bitcoin, because that's what most people are going to look at as their proxy for cryptos. A few months ago, when we held down near 30,000 and we got to 20, I think 29 and change, and then we finally shot up in, I think it was late July, we got to the low 50s. When we shot up, and in 1 week we went from, I don't know, 30,000 to 40,000 in a single week, I said that we would create a new trading range that probably ended up being the low 40s to the low 50s. So far, that's panning out. Even this week's low is, I think, 42 and change or something like that. No, I'm looking now. It's 40,000 in futures, 40,085. So just about 41,000. So anywhere down there has some support. Could you get down to the upper 30s? You could. There's Fibonacci retracements, you know, in the upper 30s. And China is saying what they're saying is significant, because if you make transactions illegal in Bitcoin, you are taking away a heck of a lot of reason that people have gotten into Bitcoin for right reasons or wrong reasons, meaning, you know, legal transference of currency versus illegal, which doesn't matter to me at this particular moment, in the sense that whatever reason you got in for, China's saying you can't do that now, at least out of their country. You cannot make transactions in cryptos. That automatically should take a demand away, right? It's demand of, what's the word I'm trying to come up with? Destruction. And the market sold off. It's bounced a little bit. It's still holding the low 40s, where they are now at 42,360 or so, and whatever the front month futures are, I guess probably November or no, I guess October. So it's an issue. If you recall, Corey, because we talked about this back in April or May, I think May, when I was on with you, I said at the time that the April high in Bitcoin was going to last far longer than people wanted to see it last. And, you know, so if it's April and we're in, so that's the fourth month, we're finishing up the ninth month now. So, you know, we've gone almost half a year now with that high still in place. And I think that that hangs around for quite a bit more as this game gets figured out, both in China, whether or not that's going to change, and whether or not any other countries decide to do anything like that. If it is, it's bad news. Basically, you have to play ranges when you play the cryptos. And, you know, it's not for most people to day trade. And but it is fairly technical. Because the fundamentals certainly are difficult to truly grasp. So if you're a good technician and understand range trading and don't worry about every dollar in something like this, I think you can trade it. So I look at it as a trading vehicle. It's something I've got some money myself in Ethereum, and, you know, I'm just holding it. And you know, I was up significantly when it was at $4,000. It's now down to closer to $3,000. So, you know, I just gave back 25% quickly. That's what you have to expect when you trade this. And if you can't handle those type moves, you shouldn't be trading cryptos. It is par for the course.
Exactly. That is cryptos, right? And that's why it sucks some people in, is because of that volatility that really has been around in the cryptos pretty much for their whole lifetime. Rick, we're going to wrap it up here. Some great comments on the markets, and also for all the gold investors, key levels to watch in the gold stocks, as this week did not end well, but it is, as you outlined, a key level for some sort of a bounce or for the gold stocks to hold. And as for cryptos, boy, oh boy, let's see how the market reacts as we progress through the weekend and into next week on the back of that China news. Rick, as always, great having you on the show, buddy. I always look forward to our conversations. I hope you have a great rest of your week, and we'll get you back on next month.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a good one.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.